Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. The Sunbury Motors Service Department is open Monday through Friday, 7 to 4. Monday through Friday, 7 to 4 for the Sunbury Motors Service Department. And check out online the great product lines that they have at Sunbury Motors. All right, so let's get to our play-by-play call of the day. Gordon Hayward at the buzzer just misses from midcourt.
Butler has no timeouts.
So they would hope that Zubek makes this.
Not going to try. It's Hayward pulling it down, getting around Zubek at midcourt, launches the shot. Oh, it almost went in! Almost went in, and Duke is the king of the dance, 2010.
That was the call. It was in Indianapolis. And Gordon Hayward of Butler just missed. Now Gordon Hayward is playing for Brad Stevens with the Boston Celtics once they get back to work. All right. He has been one of my favorites around here for a while. Yeah, 5 years he spent here, and he is coming off. He made a decision a year ago to come back and play his fifth season here at Penn State. And I think it paid off because I think he turned in his best season. I thought he had a really good season for the line. Steven Gonzalez. Steven, welcome. It's great to have you with us on the show.
Hey, Steve. How are you? Thanks for having me on the show.
Hey, it's great to have you on the show. Okay, since the Cotton Bowl, a lot's happened since that day at Jerry World. So what was your regimen before everything shut down, and then how much has it changed?
I mean, I was pretty much working out 8 to 5 every single day. I mean, I flew out to Florida right after the Cotton Bowl, and, you know, from January 2nd to, like, March 6th, I want to say, I was just working out 8 to 5, you know, doing mock combines, lifting, doing NFL interview prep, doing, you know, whole bunch, you know, the whole nine yards of this process, you know, just kind of preparing myself, you know, for pro day and things like that. Came back home for the weekend once, you know, I came back from Florida, and then was up in Penn State for a little bit. You got to see a couple of guys, Garrett, Bowers, Jan, Dan Chisena. So, you know, it was good reconnecting with some of the guys and, you know, working out there for a little bit, waiting for, you know, for pro day to happen or what was going to happen. But obviously, you know, everything got canceled and everything got shut down. So, I mean, not really much has changed. It's just trying to find a place to work out. But luckily, I have a personal trainer here that I'm working out with in New Jersey. And, you know, I'm staying in shape, you know, and just kind of trying to, you know, keep ready for once this draft comes and once, you know, hopefully I get picked up by a team and, you know, just really just stay in tip-top shape, you know, whenever, you know, things reopen again, whether we do mini camp, rookie mini camp, you know, OTA. So I just kind of want to make sure I'm prepared.
No question, and you have to be. So I want to talk about the workout part of it. Is this a case where you can work out at home? Do you have the kind of great setup at home that allows you to work out? How is that happening for you right now?
Yeah, so I mean, at home, I have a personal trainer. He has his own gym, so
okay.
You know, I'll go there about like 3 to 4 times a week. There's also a field right by his house that, you know, is still open, so. You know, we head down there a couple times throughout the week just to make sure we get some field work. So I also have my O-line coach from high school. You know, we're doing O-line drills, things like that, to just make sure I'm sharp in those areas. So also doing some snapping to get some center work so that, you know, I can show teams I can play guard and center. So, you know, I'm still keeping up my workouts. It's just Now, I wouldn't say it's not as intense as it was in Florida, but it definitely, you know, we got to, like, kind of, you know, maneuver around our situations now, especially with everything going on.
What's the center snap stuff been like? Because that's not really something that you were doing here at Penn State. And in fact, usually it was Mike Miranda that would do more of that.
Yeah, I did it at Penn State for a little bit. I was doing it in Penn State this past spring ball, actually. I did it, but then obviously as the season came closer, I stuck to guard. But, you know, it's been fun. I mean, I know all the calls at center. I know how to read defenses. I did it, you know, at guard. So it's just really the snapping part and, you know, just trying to get that down. But I feel like I've done pretty well at it. I feel like I've gotten more used to it. So, you know, it's just something that's a work in progress, and it takes some time to kind of perfect.
How tough was it when you found out you weren't going to have your pro day?
Very hard. I was there till like Friday. I think it was like the 12th or something like that, or the 15th. And, you know, I was there right there in Penn State before pro day, and they were like, oh, we're going to cancel it. You know, I got the text from, you know, Deej and Coach Franklin, and I was like, that obviously wasn't the news I wanted to hear, but, you know, I've made the best out of my situation. You know, we did mock pro days at where I was training down in Florida. So, you know, me and my agent sent scouts those videos, and we made sure that they were able to see, you know, that I can move, and, you know, I've looked really good now moving and stuff like that, running. So, you know, at the end of the day, we made the best of, you know, a bad situation, and that's pretty much what we're doing.
Part of it's also the interview process, which you alluded to in your first answer. You had to prepare how to do interviews when you get into this situation. Have you been able to talk to NFL teams along the way? And if so, how's that gone?
Here and there, teams will call. I haven't had a formal interview yet. It's been more just asking for medical information, you know, background information, you know, agent name, you know, tell me a little bit about yourself, your background. It's just teams kind of trying to get a feel for the kind of person I am. So I haven't really had a formal interview yet, but within these next 2 weeks, I'll definitely have at least one or two. So,
you put together a really good senior season. There's no getting around it. And so you had to make the decision last year to go or to come back, and then you put together a really good season. How'd you feel that panned out for you in the end?
I think I made the best choice at the end of the day. Last year, obviously, I felt like I could have left early, but, you know, at the end of the day, it was a better decision for me to stay and to have, you know, to put more tape out there. And especially now, looking back on it, with all this going on now, that, you know, my tape right now is really heavily relied on for scouts to kind of see the kind of player they're going to draft, especially since I didn't have a pro day or anything like that. So, you know, to get that extra year of film in and, you know, to pretty much have my best season that I had at Penn State, having it my senior year and having that on film for them. You know, looking back on it, I don't regret the decision at all. I don't regret it. And I got to spend another year with, you know, the Penn State family, with you guys, with the team, with the coaches, and got a Cotton Bowl win, which is always nice, too. So, you know, at the end of the day, I don't regret it. I don't regret it. And, you know, I'm going to miss Penn State.
And believe me, they're going to miss you and will miss you. I want to get to the journey along the way. You entered Penn State at a time when, okay, there wasn't a 2016 Big Ten championship, and it was important, and you and I had talked about this, and I think we talked about this at a quarterback club, too, about reminding the younger players about the journey to get here. What did that do to shape you as a person and also to shape this senior class because you understood where it was and where it is?
Yeah, I mean, it was really important. You know, when I got here in 2015, it wasn't as nice as it is now, to be honest. You know, a lot of the guys, you know, especially in the locker room, you could feel that, you know, there was, you know, the older guys had their own groups, and then the younger guys had their own groups, and they all kind of just stayed away from each other. And there wasn't a bond like there has been, you know, the past 4 or 3 years, you know, so. I mean, it's definitely important to, you know, understand that, and then, you know, I was happy to be a part of it, to be honest, and to see that growth and maturation of, you know, all the guys in that locker room, all the coaches, everyone. So, you know, I was just happy to be a part of the process and be a part of the ride. I mean, it was a great ride.
I got to ask you though, if when you played high school ball, talk about playing high school ball and where you played high school ball, because I think a lot of people may not realize it was. The field situation wasn't the greatest on the planet.
Oh, yeah. It's a really nice field, but yeah. So I played for Union City High School in New Jersey. We're right across the river from New York City.
Yep.
So we're in the Mecca. I mean, pretty much we're in the, you know, epicenter of everything happening. So, you know, there's really not that much space for a football field. So, you know, the people in our town, when they built the high school and stuff, they said, why don't we just build it on the roof? So our high school field is literally on the roof. Like, if you search up Union City High School, New Jersey football field, you'll see, like, our high school field on the roof. And it's the only high school in America, I think, that has their high school football field on the roof. It's an awesome experience. When you go up there, you see the New York skyline, and then on the other half, you see MetLife, and you see all New Jersey. So, you know, it's pretty cool up there, to be honest. And to play there for 4 years, it was also a blessing. And, you know, I got to be around a lot of great players, a lot of my good friends, and, you know, great coaches that still support me till today. So, you know, it was a great situation. But, yeah, you know, it was a little different than most high schoolers, you know, who have a regular field. We were on the roof.
How much room was there in the end zones, and how much room in the – I assume there were stands – so how much room was there in the sidelines? How big was this roof?
Oh, it's huge. I'm telling you, if you Google it, you'll see it's huge. I mean, it's a football field and a baseball field put together, pretty much.
Really?
So the only sideline that really didn't have much space was the visiting sideline, but, you know, we're not the visiting team, obviously, so we don't have to worry about that.
What was it about that attracted you to Penn State and said, you know what, that's the place I want to go?
Just, you know, Coach Franklin, obviously, you know, he has that charm about him where, you know, he can bring you in and, you know, love you up. And, you know, you kind of feel that family love. And that's kind of what I felt. And, you know, especially at that time, that's what I needed. I needed to feel like I was secure. Like, you know, I had really good people that I can, you know, put my, you know, my life and my career and put my trust into them. So, you know, at the end of the day, I felt that family environment, although it wasn't as strong as it is as it has been recently, I still felt it. And, you know, obviously great academics, great football, best environment in college football, you know, obviously the whiteout, 107,000 fans in the stadium all the time. So, you know, they have the best environment. Happy Valley is also just a great place, college campus, you know, so there's a lot of things to do. And at the end of the day, it was also close to home, which was also very helpful. You know, to be honest, I didn't really want to go to Rutgers. So, I mean, that's just personal opinion. I mean, I just didn't want to go there. So, you know, Penn State was the next best place for me, and it was, you know, it was just the best place for me. It was the best fit. And the minute I got on campus, I felt that.
You ended up getting your degree in history, and you did that a little more than a year ago. And then you started working, I think, on a second degree in rehab and human services. What attracted you to both of those degrees?
So I originally wanted to do education, some sort of field in education, but I didn't get accepted into the grad school program at Penn State. So me and Todd Colker, the academic advisor, we kind of sat down, we talked about it, we said maybe rehabilitation human services would be the next best thing, because you could take education courses as you build up, you know, whatever credentials you need to get into the education grad school. So I worked on that for, you know, a whole semester and just, you know, did my best. But it also helped because it took that pressure off from school. I mean, not that I didn't focus on school or didn't
sure.
do well, but it allowed me to focus more on football, which is really what was more important at the end of the day. And that's kind of what my main focus was coming back, because I knew I wasn't going to be able to go into grad school. So I was like, let me shift my focus into football. I'm still going to do well in school, so that's not going to matter.
Right.
So at the end of the day, it was very helpful, and it was the best situation for me.
One thing about the banquet, I had a real chance to meet your mom, and tremendous. I mean, what has she meant to you?
She means the world to me. She's my rock. She's, you know, she's always been there for me no matter what, sacrificed so much for me. I mean, she did drives this past year, literally, that I told her not to do it. Like, I even told, like, I told her, do not come to this game. She's like, no, I have to. So, you know, she drove literally from New Jersey to Iowa. That was like an 18-something-hour drive.
Oh.
So, you know, so she's just sacrificed so much for me, and, you know, I don't know how I can repay her. I don't think I ever can. So, you know, but yeah, so she means the world to me.
One of the keys for anybody is they need to improve from year to year. So in the last couple of seasons, Where did you concentrate on a couple of areas that you just said, you know what, I know I need to improve, and then you know in seeing a tape and actually playing a game where you know you actually did improve and get better?
I think this past year especially, just being able to move, obviously that helps with losing weight. Right now I'm like at 325, so, you know, I'm feeling really good, moving really well. But and then I played the whole season pretty much at like 320, 325 range. So, you know, and you could tell on tape that I just look better moving, especially in pass pro and things like that. But I felt like just being able to, just to improve on, footwork speed, moving, getting up to the next level, getting on guys at the next level. And then in pass pro, as an offensive lineman, you're never going to be perfect at anything. There's always going to be one thing you're going to have to work on. So, I always try to focus on, working on my hands, independent hands, shooting, punching, making sure I hit my target. And then obviously, in my sets, just making sure I don't overset, I don't underset, that, I set the defender really well, and, I don't out-leverage myself, so there's always just, like I said, as an offensive lineman, there's always things you need to work on. You literally can never be perfect. You always have to work on something, whether it's mentally or physically, so.
I want to ask you about the weight part, because at 323, 325, you could see it. But you always had to fight, when you were here to somehow get to that number. How tough was that for you?
It was tough, especially, after the bowl games and things like that. That's when you gain the most weight, especially during that time. It doesn't help to come home and, you get all the food from Christmas and things like that. So, but at the end of the day, it was just a long process, and, always losing that weight was pretty tough. But, I had a really good support staff. When little Deej was here, he would help me out a lot. And then this past year, Coach Gall helped me out a lot. Coach Earls helped me out a lot. So, and it was more just kind of self-motivation, just wanting myself to be better and just kind of, making sure I was really prepared for the season.
How anxious are you now to get to that draft weekend to see if, things will get solved one way or the other. You're either going to get drafted or you're going to get signed as a free agent, one of the two. But how anxious are you to finally then find out exactly where?
I'm pretty anxious, especially now, the process without this, all the issues going on in the world now, the process was already, a lot of unknown. You're not going to know what's going to happen on draft day. I always use Connor's example that, he never got a call from the Cowboys, but he ends up getting drafted by them in the third round. So It's a lot of uncertainty even before what's happened. And now, especially after everything that's happened, it's just so much uncertainty. So, I'm just really anxious, but, I'm excited for, whatever team decides to pick me up. I'm going to be always grateful for it. And, I'm going to work my butt off the minute they pick me up.
They'll be really fortunate to get you, and I will attest to that over and over again. Steven, thanks so much. My best to you and your family. Everybody stay safe, and we appreciate you very much. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Steve. Appreciate you, and stay safe.
Steven Gonzalez, former Nittany Lion, anxiously awaiting the next step in his life. Then again, aren't we all? Lynn Shapiro, next half hour, will join us from the Washington Post on the late, great Bobby Mitchell as we continue here on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by Sunbury Motors. When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC Way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC Way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC Way. The SMC Way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years. All right. right. Welcome back. Great to have you with us on the show today. Brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Again, the Sunbury Motors Service Department, outstanding. Open Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. And check out the great product lines online for Sunbury Motors. Bobby Mitchell was a great player and a trailblazer as well. The Redskins were the last NFL, you know, the existing NFL teams at that time to integrate. And the player that led that way was Bobby Mitchell. But Bobby Mitchell was also a great player. Terrific halfback with the Cleveland Browns. He and Jim Brown made a dynamic backfield. But then he got dealt and was moved to flanker by the Redskins, and he became a dynamic wide receiver. Len Shapiro covered the Redskins for 45 seasons. 45 seasons. And he's going to be on with us in the next half hour to talk about the legacy of Bobby Mitchell, the Hall of Famer who passed away this week at the age of 84. Today's show brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. You can look at the great products online. Remember, we're in a time right now where we've got some great interest rates. So check out the great product lines online. And also, don't forget about the fabulous service department. They take care of exactly what you need to your satisfaction. That service department open 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday. 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday. All right. He was one of the greats, Bobby Mitchell. We're number 49 with the Washington Redskins for the majority of his career. He did start out his career in the same backfield with the great Jim Brown with the Cleveland Browns. And Bobby Mitchell came along at a time where he made the Redskins dynamic offensively with Sonny Jurgensen as his quarterback and Charlie Taylor and Jerry Smith and those guys. Len Shapiro covered the Redskins for 45 years, including the Bobby Mitchell years. With the Washington Post. And with that, we welcome Len to the show. Len, a pleasure. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Steve.
Len, let's Bobby Mitchell. I want to get to Bobby Mitchell, the player, first. He's with the Browns, and he's a running back with Jim Brown. And then he goes to the Redskins, and he becomes a flank and, you know, is with Sonny Jurgensen. How great a player was he, and impactful to an offense was he?
Well, I mean, in both places, he was a vital cog. In my mind, the backfield with the Browns, Jim Brown and Bobby Mitchell was, in my mind, the greatest backfield in the history of the NFL. Mitchell was Barry Sanders before there was a Barry Sanders.
Yep.
He was a flashy runner. With unbelievable speed. You know, at one point, he held the world indoor record for the short hurdles race. I think it was the 60-yard hurdles. And, of course, it was broken about a couple of weeks later. But that's how fast the guy was. And he had wonderful moves, and of course, he could catch a lot of passes. When he went to the Redskins in a very controversial trade for all the obvious reasons, he was moved to flanker because the Redskins had drafted another pretty good athlete named Charlie Taylor, who had been a running back at Arizona State. And so why not get both of them on the field at the same time? So the Redskins coach, Bill McPeak, moved Bobby Mitchell over to flanker, and in his first game, he caught seven passes. His first home game, had 140 yards receiving, seven catches, two touchdowns, and then went on to play 7 years for the Redskins, and played with two other great wide receivers, Charlie Taylor, who later was switched by Otto Graham to wide receiver, and a tight end named Jerry Smith, who when he retired had more touchdown passes than any tight end in the history of the league, and probably should be in the Hall of Fame as well. So you had two Hall of Famers and a guy who should be in the Hall of Fame in the same receiving corps. And again, in my mind, maybe the greatest receiving trio in the history of the league as well.
If you wonder how the Redskins put 72 up on the Giants in 1966, that's how they did it with this kind of offense. Let's see, Mitchell's...
Well, by the way, in that game, they also kicked a field goal ahead when they had 69 points, ordered by Sam Huff, the Hall of Fame linebacker, who was so furious at the Giants to trading him to the Redskins, he wanted to rub it into Alex Sherman a little bit.
Was it Charlie Gogolak that kicked that?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah,
the Princeton Gogolak, whoever that was.
Yeah, Pete Gogolak's brother. So Bobby Mitchell makes this move. Obviously a great player, but he also had the pressure of breaking the barrier in Washington, which I believe was the last established NFL team at the time to break the barrier. How aware of it was he of this the entire time, and how much pressure did that put on him?
Tremendous amount of pressure, and he knew it. There also were two other black players on that team, both of whom whose names you'll never know, and I'm forgetting right now. One of them was a guy named John Nesbitt, who was a guard, and another running back. I think his name was Leroy Thomas. Anyway, long ago forgotten. In any case, Mitchell was the star, obviously the marquee attraction in that. And, of course, the Redskins had made a trade with the Browns. The Redskins sent their number one pick, Ernie Davis, to Cleveland for Mitchell and a couple of other things. But it was a trade that Cleveland owner Art Modell didn't even know about until he got a phone call from the Redskins owner, George Preston Marshall, who called him one night and said, "Hey, that was a hell of a trade." And Modell said, "What trade?" It turned out that Paul Brown, his coach, had made the trade without ever telling Modell. A year later, Modell fired Paul Brown in one of the most controversial moves in Brown's history. But that's another story. Mitchell was very aware of his place. But he always said he never wanted to be remembered just for integrating a team that was the last team in the NFL not to have black players. It was owned by a racist owner, essentially. He thought he always thought the Redskins were the team of the South long before there were the Falcons, the Saints.
Right.
Thought that if he had a black player on his roster, people wouldn't come out to see him play. In any case, Mitchell knew about his role, was extremely proud of his role, but was equally proud, if not more proud, of his accomplishments on the playing field, not to mention his wonderful family.
Yeah, no question. In fact, he thought of the Redskins as the team of the South that when the Cowboys came into existence, he was doing everything he could to block the Cowboys radio network because he owned the South. In terms of radio coverage, I mean that's how much he thought of his team as the team of the South.
Oh yeah, they played all their exhibition games up and down the East Coast. He had radio stations going as far south as Key West, which is as far south as you can get. But he had them in the Carolinas, in Georgia, and Florida, everywhere you could. Virginia, obviously, closest to the where there's still rabid Redskins fans, even as far down as Richmond and Norfolk and even further south than that. But yes, it was the team of the South. Marshall had grown up in D.C., in white D.C., was a rabid segregationist.
Yep.
That's the way he operated.
And for those of you who ever look at old tapes, by the way, I think Charlie Taylor would have been 42, Mitchell would have been 49, and Jerry Smith would have been 87, I think. So if you
87. Yep. 87 is exactly right,
yep.
Yes.
So if you look at old tapes, that's what you'd be looking at. We talk about Bobby.
And of course, Sonny Jurgensen was the quarterback.
Well, that's the next question I was going to have. Now, Sonny Jurgensen is the quarterback. They get him from the Eagles in the Norm Snead trade. And so now he's there in Washington. What did it mean when you talked to Bobby Mitchell, and then let's flip it over to Sonny Jurgensen. What did Mitchell mean to Jurgensen, but what did Jurgensen then mean to Mitchell from each of their perspectives, Len?
Well, everything. They were great. They became great friends. In my mind, again, I'm going with hyperbole, but I covered the league, you know, for almost 45 years.
Right.
Jurgensen is the greatest pure passer I've ever seen, with only Dan Marino right behind him. So you had the greatest pure passer. You had a Mitchell coming at, you know, as a flanker and never dropped the ball. And Sonny could thread the needle anytime he wanted to. And they had great respect for each other. They became great friends. They always spoke very highly of each other, and were great friends till the day Mitchell died. Jurgensen is a couple of years older, in his middle to late 80s, and maybe the most popular athlete in the history of Washington D.C. Maybe with ahead of John Riggins and Frank Howard and lots of others, but. I've never seen anything like that. When they played on Sunday, I mean, it was just a circus, an offensive circus. The bad news is a defense stunk.
Yeah, that's why they tried to acquire Sam Huff to try and make it a little bit better. If they could.
And it still stunk.
It still stunk. We'll get Brig Owens on the show at some point. When Vince Lombardi gets there, Mitchell's no longer playing. But how important was it to Bobby Mitchell that Vince Lombardi was able to get him into the front office at that particular time and then to give him a second career?
Yeah, well, it was the right thing to do. Bobby decided that after 11 years, his body had had it, and he just didn't think he could probably perform up to Lombardi's very rigorous standards, although I guarantee you Lombardi would have kept him around in a heartbeat just to have him in the locker room.
Yep.
And even with some diminished skills, Bobby would have been among the top two or three receivers on the team. But yes, it was important that he stayed with the team. Lombardi used him as a scout, which was a role he fulfilled for a couple of years. When George Allen came to town, Bobby stayed in the front office and scouted, but also was the eyes and ears for the team president and part owner back then, the great attorney Edward Bennett Williams, who ran the operation because Jack Kent Cook owned franchises in the NHL and NBA and was not by rule allowed to be the managing director or the managing owner of the Redskins. So Mitchell was the voice who let Williams know what was going on, and then was very deeply, deeply hurt when Allen left the team and Ed Williams hired Bobby Beathard as ex-general manager and passed over Bobby, who by that time had been an assistant general manager. Bobby was hurt a second time after Bobby Beathard left in the late 80s, this time it was Jack Kent Cook who bypassed Mitchell for the GM job, and Mitchell was very bitter about both those snubs. And he would have been the first black general manager in the league and would have been a terrific general manager as well.
And not only that, but then Steve Spurrier issued number 49 to a player. I mean, every time you turn around, I want to say it was Leonard Stevens or somebody like that. I think I read it somewhere.
Yes, it was. It was Leonard Stevens. It was a second-string tight end. And that was the Spurrier era under Dan Snyder, who also did no favors to Bobby as well. So Bobby quit in 2003 after 41 years with the organization as a player and a team executive.
Great family man. Bobby Mitchell's a great family man. His wife, Gwen, was an attorney.
Yes.
And Len, what did Bobby Mitchell mean to the community, and how much did he give back to the community with his influence?
Tremendous amount. He also, back in the 60s, became good friends with Bobby Kennedy.
Yes.
And they did some in fact, Kennedy dedicated a playground with Bobby right at his side about 6 weeks after his brother had been assassinated. And Bobby always said that Bobby Kennedy said, I'm not sure I can do this, Bobby. And Mitchell said later, he said, I held onto the shovel with Bobby, who was so nervous, and we threw the dirt over our head. It's probably still flying. They were friends. Bobby was always involved in community activities, and then ironically, he got very much involved with the battle against leukemia. And ironically, the guy that he was traded for, Ernie Davis, yes, who the Redskins had drafted, of course, never played a regular season game in the NFL and died of leukemia tragically that first year. But Bobby's cause was leukemia. He actually held a golf tournament every year. It was called Bobby Mitchell's Hall of Fame Classic. And when you would go out to get in your cart, chances are you'd be sitting next to a Hall of Famer in baseball, in hockey, in basketball, and in football. You know, it could be Jim Brown. It could be Bobby Orr. It could be Oscar Robertson. He made a lot of money, which was contributed to the Leukemia Foundation. So Bobby was very, very much community-oriented, but also a very normal guy. I mean, you know, he never... he was NFL royalty, a Hall of Famer in 1983, yep, but he was just Bobby Mitchell. And if you knew who he was, great. If you didn't know who he was, that was great. He was just a fabulous human being, terrific guy, great player, great family man. His son Neil also went to the University of Illinois. He had a daughter named Terry. Neil was a ball boy at training camp when I was covering the Redskins. And I can tell you now, it was a great source.
Sure. Hey, can I ask you just one side note? Just one side
sure.
note in all of this. And that is with Lombardi. He had the one
yes.
year with the Redskins before he passed away. Len, in being around it at that time, what did he mean just in the one year to the future of the Redskins? Because from that point, it did take off. Because if I remember, his first Packers team went 7-5, and the Redskins went 7-5-2, I think, in that one season. What did he mean to the future of the Redskins and stabilizing the organization?
It was unbelievable. In fact, the year he came, 1969, was also the year that Lefty Driesell came to the University of Maryland as the basketball coach,
yep,
and Ted Williams came to the Washington Senators as the baseball coach. Yep. I mean, you can't ask for anything better than that. But as far as the Redskins went, the 7-5-2 record, I think, was their first winning season in about 20, 25 years, maybe since World War II. And Lombardi, you know, it was the first time Sonny Jurgensen reported to training camp without a pot belly. Lombardi took over a team that should not have had a winning season. I mean, they were terrible. They had a great offense. Again, they had a terrible defense. Sam Huff was a player coach, coached the linebackers. They won a lot of games. They won seven games. And then, sadly, after the season, Lombardi complained of stomach problems and went to Georgetown University Hospital. And was found to have colon cancer. And in fact, as a Cub reporter, one of my early assignments for the Post was to go, and it's a terrible thing to say, but it was basically I had to go to Georgetown Hospital for the death watch. And, you know, if he died between our first edition and our last edition, I had to get to a payphone and get me rewrite and report on it. So, but his legacy was such that he finally gave the Redskins a taste of what winning was like. He was replaced in 1907 by a non-entity named Bill Austin, who was his offensive line coach. But then in 1971, Edward Bennett Williams hired George Allen, and the rest, as they say, is history. You know, Allen made the playoffs the first year, got the team into the Super Bowl the second year, and then the whole thing took off, and that led to Joe Gibbs in the 80s. And then, of course, it all went to hell when Dan Snyder took over 20 years ago.
Well said. Len, this was great. I just love talking about this stuff. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time, your insight, your perspective. Thank you.
At any time, Stan. By the way, I'm a University of Wisconsin graduate. So the hell with
him. I'll tell Matt LePay when I see him.
Feel free.
Indeed. Len Shapiro. By the way, part of the lasting legacy of Lombardi with the Washington Redskins, the Redskins had an outstanding running back that was a big reason why they got to the Super Bowl, Super Bowl VII, named Larry Brown. Larry Brown, in fact, was out of Clareton, out in the western part of the state. Went to Shenley High School. And he was a running back out of Kansas State. In the eighth round, Vince Lombardi picked him. And ended up being a four-time Pro Bowler, and he's a big reason why they got to this Super Bowl. He was the MVP in 72. I mean, that's part of the legacy of Vince Lombardi. In the 1 year, he was the vice president, general manager, coach, I think he owned a percentage of the team, too, with the Washington Redskins. We'll come back, wrap it up in a moment here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Yeah, you know, NFL Network, I want to say 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, did a timeline, a one-hour timeline on Vince Lombardi's 1 year with the Washington Redskins. And I've always found in history that was one of the more fascinating seasons because Lombardi, so iconic in his years with the Giants, so iconic and beyond that with his years with the Packers, and then he gets back in it with the Redskins, and all the Redskins did was lose for decades. And it was a time of, you know, there was strife in this country. It's 1969. And there are several players that were in the National Guard. We just talked about Jerry Smith, for example. The tight end was a really good player. He caught 3 touchdown passes in a game after he was up all night on patrol with the National Guard. And what Lombardi's one season with the Redskins did with this, it reinforced his greatness. All those things that he employed during his glory days in Green Bay, it showed it worked with other people in another city. Today's show brought to you by Sunbury Motors.